Coda, The Horizon. 10:18, September 12th, 2035, GMT plus 4:30, Isfahan. Finally, he was home. The trip to Bandar Abbas had been the first of any kind Major General Qasem Farshad had made in the past year since his promotion and subsequent retirement. He dropped his bags by the front door, went straight to the bedroom, and stripped out of his uniform. He'd forgotten how much he hated wearing it. Or, put another way, he had forgotten how much he'd come to enjoy not wearing it. He thought over the difference between the two as he showered and changed into the polyester tracksuit that had become his new uniform around the house. While he tied on his sneakers, he reminded himself that he didn't harbor any real grudges against Bagheri and the others in the high command. He simply wanted to embrace this new life. On the return flight from Bandar Abbas, he had worked on his memoir, as he did most every morning, and now he was looking forward to his customary walk around his property and to settling back into the comfort of his routine. When the invitation to Bandar Abbas had arrived some weeks before, Farshad had initially refused it. Ever since the victory of the Strait, as the High Command had anointed his last battle, his country had heaped honor after honor on his shoulders, from his second awarding of the Order of the Fat to a mention by the Supreme Leader in a nationally televised address to the Parliament. Had such recognition arisen from another battle, one where the difference between victory and defeat hadn't come down to which direction the wind was blowing, perhaps Farshad would have felt otherwise about accepting the invitation. Now, finally home, he first thought to unpack, but then decided he would do it that night. He would instead have a long walk to stretch his legs. He went to the kitchen and prepared himself his usual simple lunch, a boiled egg, a piece of bread, some olives. He placed the meal in a paper sack and set out across his property. Trees canopied his route. The first autumn colors already touched the rims of their leaves, and in the early afternoon the cool air hinted at the passing of the seasons. Late blooming wildflowers lined his path as he headed along dirt-packed trails toward the ribbon of stream bisecting his property. Farshad could hardly believe it had been more than a year since those Russian paratroopers had been blown out to sea. He couldn't quite decide whether a great deal of time had passed or not very much at all. When he thought of the specifics of the battle in the Strait, it felt like not very much. When he thought of how much the world had changed since then, it seemed as though far more than a year had passed. Farshad now understood himself as a small actor in a far broader war, one that had resulted in a profound global realignment. When Farshad was bracing for a Russian attack against his island fortifications, he had no inkling that the Indians had intervened on the side of peace by sinking a Chinese carrier and destroying an American fighter squadron. Tragically, a single pilot from that squadron managed to slip both the Indian interceptors and Chinese air defenses, dropping his payload on Shanghai. These many months later, the city remained a charred radioactive wasteland. The death toll had exceeded 30 million. After each of the nuclear attacks, international markets plummeted, crops failed, infectious diseases spread. Radiation poisoning promised to contaminate generations. The devastation exceeded Farshad's capacity for comprehension. Though he'd spent his entire adult life at war, not even he could grasp such losses. Compared to the trilateral conflict between the Americans, Chinese, and Indians, his country's contest with the Russians felt, in retrospect, like little more than an intramural squabble. In Parliament and among the High Command, there had been some question as to whether the captured Russian prisoners qualified as prisoners of war, seeing as the two nations were not in a state of formal hostilities. In Tehran, zealots within the government had threatened to classify the Russians as bandits and execute them accordingly. However, when as part of the New Delhi Peace Accords negotiated by the Indians, the United Nations announced its reorganization, the Supreme Leader astutely leveraged clemency for the imprisoned Russians as a way to secure a permanent Iranian seat on the Security Council, which the Indians had already insisted on relocating from New York City to Mumbai as a precondition of delivering a direly needed multi-year aid package to the United States. Out on his walk, Farshad arrived at the stream on his property. He stepped onto the footbridge, leaned against its balustrade, and gazed into the clear glacial melt that passed below. His thoughts turned from the last year to the last few days, to his trip to Bandar Abbas, and the final, albeit somewhat absurd, honor that the Navy had bestowed on him, the dedication of a vessel in his name. Admittedly, Farshad had been quite flattered at first, although he was technically retired as an officer in the Revolutionary Guards. The Navy had taken him in when his career was in tatters, and now, bedecked with his newfound glory, they proved keen to claim Farshad as their own. He pictured the sleek prow of a frigate or cruiser with his name emblazoned on its side. He could envision the teeth of its magnificent anchor and its decks bristling with rockets, missiles, guns, and a crew that kept the ship and thus his name gleaming as it crossed horizon after horizon. Several weeks passed while arrangements were made for Farshad's travel to Bandar Abbas. Then the Navy forwarded along the specifications of the vessel that would bear his name. Not a frigate, not a cruiser, not even a puny yet swift corvette. A photograph of the undedicated vessel accompanied the announcement. The shape of its hull was like a wooden shoe, wide in the front, narrow in the back, functional, but not something anyone would wish to be seen in. The decision had been made to dedicate a newly laid Delvar-class logistic ship in his honor. Standing on the footbridge over the stream, Farshad leaned forward and considered his reflection as he thought of the many photographs that had been taken of him over these past few days. When he'd arrived in Bandar Abbas, the Navy had scheduled an ambitious itinerary. After dedicating the ship, he accompanied it out to sea for its maiden voyage, which took them to the now heavily garrisoned islands in the Strait of Hormuz, where he'd fought his famous battle. As a surprise, and a signal that Iran would lead the nations of the world in the process of reconciliation, there was a guest visitor aboard, Commander Vasily Kolchak. Kolchak, it turned out, had been part of the Russian invasion fleet a year before. The two were scheduled to sail through the Strait of Hormuz together, allies turned adversaries, then allies again. He was pleased to see Kolchak, who had also been promoted since their last encounter. The dedication ceremony was on the whole a pleasant affair, except when the seas rose late that afternoon. The pitch and roll of the little, flat-hulled logistic ship that bore Farshad's name soon proved too much for him. He spent the final hours of the maiden voyage locked in the latrine, retching, while his old friend Kolchak stood vigil outside the door, doing Farshad one last favor. He made certain nobody witnessed the greatest naval hero in a generation, bent over on all fours, debilitated by seasickness. As Farshad rested on the footbridge, recalling these past few days, he felt reassured to know that in all likelihood, he would never again see a body of water larger than the little stream that babbled pleasantly below his feet. He continued on his walk. The leaf-filtered sun fell along the path and on Farshad's upturned and smiling face. It felt good to have the steady earth beneath him. He breathed deeply and quickened his pace. Soon he was at the far end of his property, near the elm where he was in the habit of taking his lunch. He sat with his back against the trunk. On his lap, he spread out his meal, the egg, the bread, the olives. Since his bout of seasickness, his appetite hadn't quite returned. He only nibbled at his food. He thought of Kolchak. When the two had a quiet moment on the ship that bore Farshad's name, the Russian had asked him what he would do now that he was retired. Farshad didn't mention his memoirs. That would have been too presumptuous. Instead, he talked about this land, his walks, a quiet life in the countryside. Kolchak had laughed uproariously. When Farshad asked what was so funny, Kolchak said that he never took Farshad as one for the quiet life. He had expected Farshad to try his hand at politics or business, to use his notoriety to vault toward the topmost rungs of power. Farshad finished his lunch. He wondered what his old mentor, Soleimani, would think of his decision to strive for a quieter life. It was, after all, Soleimani who had wished a soldier's death for his young protege, as opposed to the withering away he himself had feared and so narrowly avoided. How many times and on how many battlefields had Farshad cheated death? Too many to count. But as he thought of this, he began to wonder whether he'd cheated death, or if it was death who had cheated him, never granting the end that Soleimani had wished for Farshad. Still, sitting beneath the elm at the edge of his property, Farshad couldn't quite bring himself to wish that he'd died on a battlefield. Didn't a soldier deserve the fruits of his labor? It seemed fitting that at the end of his days, a soldier would become an intimate with peace. One might argue that the highest achievement for a soldier wasn't to die on the battlefield, but rather to pass away quietly in a piece of his own creation. A few morsels of his meal remained. Farshad flattened the paper sack in front of him on the grass, placing a piece of egg, a crust of bread, and two olives in a neat arrangement. He waited. Waiting as he'd done nearly every day since his return home the year before, he dozed off. When he awoke, the afternoon sun held just above the treetops. The shadows had lengthened. Now he saw what he'd been watching for. Standing in the open grass was the single squirrel, the white-tailed one whose partner had bit Farshad long ago. He placed the crust in his hand, offering it to her. She wouldn't come. Yet she wouldn't run away either. On many an afternoon, the two of them had sat fixed in a similar impasse. It always ended when Farshad walked off and the squirrel safely ate what he left behind on the paper sack. But Farshad wouldn't quit. Eventually, he would convince her to trust him enough to eat again from his open palm. What would Kolchak, Bagheri, Soleimani, or even his father think if they could see him now? Reduced to this, an old man coaxing this helpless creature toward him. But Farshad no longer cared. "I'm not giving up," he whispered to the squirrel. "Come closer, my friend. Don't you believe even an old man can change?"
0725, October 3rd, 2036. GMT minus 4. Newport. New home, new city. The loss of her father. The overworked guidance counselor at their local middle school had told the girl's mother that the first year would be the hardest. Yet the second year was proving harder still. When they'd left their home in Beijing for the countryside, her mother had said it would only be for a few days. The girl had repeatedly asked to speak to her father on the phone, and her mother had tried to call, but couldn't reach him. According to her mother, he had been doing important work for their government. She was old enough to understand that there had been a war on, that this was the reason they'd had to leave the capital. However, she wasn't quite old enough to understand her father's role. That understanding would come later, after Shanghai, when she and her mother were recalled to Beijing. She remembered the old man who'd come to their apartment. Several of his large attendants in dark suits had waited outside the door. The old man carried himself like a well-dressed peasant. When her mother told her to go to her room so they could speak, the old man insisted that the girl stay. He cupped her cheek in his hand and said,
"You look very much like your father. I see his intelligence in your eyes."
The old man went on to tell them that their home wasn't their home anymore, that her father, intelligent as he was, had had bad luck. He'd made some mistakes, and he wouldn't be returning. Her mother would cry later, at night, when she thought her daughter couldn't hear her. but she didn't betray a single emotion in front of the old man, who suggested they go live in the United States.
"This will help things," he said.
And then he asked if there was anywhere in particular that they would like to go.
"Newport,"
her mother answered. That's where they'd been happiest. And so they went. Her mother explained to her that they were lucky. Her father had gotten himself into trouble, and they might have found themselves in prison, or worse. Except the government needed someone to blame for what had happened in Shanghai. They would blame her father. They would tout his disloyalty. They would accuse him of having conspired with the Americans. The proof of this would be his family's abrupt departure to the United States. Her mother told her these things so that she would know that they weren't true.
"This new life," her mother had said, "is what your father left us. We have become his second chance."
Her mother, the wife of an admiral and a diplomat, now worked 14-hour days cleaning rooms at two separate chain hotels. The girl had offered to help, to also get a job, but her mother placed limits on her own humiliation, and seeing her daughter's education sacrificed to menial labor would have breached those limits. Instead, the girl attended school full-time. In solidarity with her mother, she helped keep the studio apartment they shared impeccably clean. Her mother never settled for menial labor. When she wasn't working, she was searching for a better job. On several occasions, she reached out to the local Chinese community, those immigrants who'd arrived on American shores within the last one or two generations, her presumed allies who now owned small businesses, restaurants, dry cleaners, even car dealerships sprouting up around Route 138. Although America was a place where people came to make a new life, for both mother and daughter, their old lives followed them. The Chinese community had to contend with the suspicions of other Americans, many of whom assumed their complicity in the recent devastation. Unfair as that assumption was, such assumptions in times of war were an American tradition, from Germans to Japanese to Muslims and now Chinese. Helping the wife and daughter of a deceased Chinese admiral would only heighten suspicions against anyone foolish enough to assume the undertaking. The community of Chinese immigrants rejected the girl and her mother. So her mother continued with her menial labor. One day a week she had off from work, but it didn't always fall on a weekend, so it was the rare occasion when mother and daughter could spend a free day together. When they had their day, they always chose to do the same thing. They would take the bus to Goat Island, rent a dinghy from the marina, let out full sail, and head north, tucking beneath the Claiborne Pell suspension bridge up toward the Naval War College, the same route they'd taken years before with Lin Bao. They never spoke his name around the house, fearful of who might still be listening. Out here, however, on the open water, who could hear them? They were beyond reach and free to say what they pleased, which was why it was on the water, shortly after they passed beneath the bridge and 2 years after they'd first arrived, that her mother admitted she'd finally stopped looking for a different job.
"Nothing better is coming," she conceded to her daughter. "We must accept this. Your father would expect us to be strong enough to accept it. No one here trusts us, not even our own people. We'll never be Americans," the girl said bitterly.
She sat slumped next to her mother, the two of them side by side in the stern of the dinghy. Her mother held the tiller. She didn't look at her daughter, but at the horizon, trying to keep them on course.
"You don't understand," her mother eventually said. "We are from nowhere and have nothing. We have come here to be from somewhere and to have something. That is what makes us American."
The two sat silently for a time. A spray of water came over the bow as they crossed the wake of a much larger ship, the uncaring wave almost swamping their small dinghy. When they arrived off the coast of the Naval War College, they drew in the sail, lifted the tiller, and dropped their small anchor. Their dinghy bobbed in the gentle swells. The two of them, mother and daughter, didn't speak. They watched the shore, the familiar pathways, the office where he had once worked, the life they'd once had, and perhaps would someday have again.
1725, June 12th, 2037, GMT-6, New Mexico. The ranch house was built in the center of her 100-acre plot. The renovation had taken 3 years and most of her savings, but Sarah Hunt was starting to feel as though it was home. The house itself wasn't much, a single floor with exposed timbers and rafters. She still didn't have anything to hang on the walls and wondered if she ever would. Most of her photos she kept in storage. On a few occasions since retiring, after one sleepless, sweat-soaked night or another, she would go out to the shed in the back of the house and consider burning the single box that contained the photographs. But it hadn't come to that. At least not yet. After Shanghai, the dreams got worse. Or not necessarily worse, but more frequent. Night after night, she would be standing on the dock with the seemingly infinite parade of ships offloading their cargo of ghosts while she searched for her father. She never found him. Not once. Yet she remained unconvinced that her searching in the dreams was futile. For a long time, she hoped that when she finished her new home, the dreams might stop. And if they never stopped, she at least hoped to find something or someone recognizable in them. That hadn't yet proven the case. She had gone on and off medication to no effect. She had spoken to therapists who only seemed to want to bury her beneath the weight of her own words, so she'd stopped talking to them. Each day, she walked the perimeter of her property, though it made her bad leg ache. 8 miles from her nearest neighbor, her plot of high desert brought her a modicum of peace. Despite the dreams, out here she could at least sleep. After the strike on Shanghai, she'd gone nearly a week with no sleep at all, her nerves so frayed that Hendrickson had to fly out to the Enterprise and relieve her of command himself, in the midst of the ceasefire negotiations being brokered by New Delhi. He had been gentle with her then, and he had remained gentle with her in the 3 years since. Predictably, he'd stayed in the Navy, pinning on a third star in his ascent to its highest ranks. A reward, and a deserved one, for the role he'd played in brokering the peace. On his visits, which had become less frequent, he always assured her that there was nothing she could have done to prevent Shanghai. She hadn't been the one to issue the launch order. Once the 9 Hornets had departed the Enterprise, there was nothing she could have done. If anything, the 1 Hornet getting to its target might have proven crucial to ending the war. During the ceasefire negotiations that followed, it had been essential for hawks like Wisecarver to make the face-saving claim that they had avenged the attacks against Galveston and San Diego. Without that claim, Hendrickson felt certain no ceasefire agreement would have been signed. "This wasn't your fault," he would say. "Then whose fault was it?" she would ask. "Not yours." And they would leave it at that. For the first year and into the second, Hendrickson would offer to help her in the ways he thought she needed help.
"Why don't you come stay with us for a bit?" Or, "I'm worried about you out here on your own."
He thought it might be good for her to get back on the water again. Healing was the word he'd used. Hunt had reminded him that it was no accident she'd bought property in New Mexico, a landlocked state. In the third year, on one of his now rare visits, the two had decided to take a stroll around her property before dinner. During a lull in their conversation, she finally asked, "Will you help me with something?"
"Anything," he answered.
"I'm thinking about adopting."
"Adopting what?"
he replied, as if he were hoping she might say a cat or a dog. They continued to walk in silence, until eventually, Hendrickson muttered,
"Whosoever destroys one life has destroyed the world entire, and whosoever saves a single life is considered to have saved the whole world." What the hell is that supposed to mean? She asked.
Isn't that why you want to adopt?
I never thought I'd hear you quote scripture. Hendrickson shrugged.
I heard Trent Wise Carver say it once, though I don't think he believed it. Do you?
They had come to a portion of her fence that needed mending. Instead of answering, Hunt bent down and cradled one of the heavy joists in her arms. She lifted with all her strength, exhaling sharply as she jammed its end into an upright. It would hold, at least temporarily, until she could make a permanent fix. She did this again with the joist's other end. Then she wiped her dirty hands on the front of her jeans. I've already started the adoption process, she said matter-of-factly. I'm not asking for your opinion. I'm only asking for your help. They require letters of reference. You're a war hero. One from you might mean something. Hendrickson didn't answer. They finished their walk, had their dinner, and the next morning he left. A week passed, a month, and then several more. She fixed the fence on her property. She remodeled the ranch house, turning her study into a nursery. Her application for adoption continued its slow bureaucratic progress. She provided bank statements. She submitted herself to interviews, to home visits. She knew the odds were stacked against her. She was a single woman and over 50 years old, or of an advanced age, as phrased by the New Mexico Children, Youth, and Families Department. But none of this would disqualify her. What would disqualify her, she feared, was what had happened on the open ocean 3 years before. Would her government entrust her to nurture a single life after entrusting her to end so many? She didn't know. Then, quite by surprise, a sealed letter arrived in the mail. She didn't need to open it. Hunt understood what Hendrickson had done for her. She forwarded along this letter to the adoption authority. The process continued. Step by step, she moved through it, transforming herself into a prospective mother and transforming her isolated ranch into a suitable home. The social worker assigned to her case, a no-nonsense official who seemed impervious to chit-chat and who wore a modest gold crucifix outside her turtleneck, reminded Hunt of Commander Jane Morris, which reminded her of the John Paul Jones. Hunt was so haunted by the resemblance that on the home visit she'd chosen to sit alone in her living room, as opposed to walking through the house with the social worker, a breach of manners that likely didn't work to her advantage. When the social worker finished her hour-long inspection, she exited the nursery and commented,
"You'd never know you'd been in the Navy walking around this house. You don't have a single photo out."
Hunt hadn't had a response, or at least not one she felt prepared to give. Before she left, the social worker told Hunt she would receive a phone call in the coming days as to her eligibility to become an adoptive parent. In the days that followed, Hunt hardly slept. Her dreams returned with a ferocity she hadn't known since immediately after Shanghai. The ships unload their cargo. Panicked, she searches for her father, knowing she'll never find him. On and on the dream spirals, only increasing in intensity. Until, one morning, in the midst of her dream, she is released from her familiar terror by a sound. Her phone was ringing.
1712, November 24th, 2038, GMT minus 6, Kansas City, Missouri. The bedroom hadn't changed in 2 decades. Posters of fighter jets, from the Corsair to the Phantom to the Hornet. A Super Bowl victory poster from 2017, the year Tom Brady became the GOAT. Varsity trophies littered the desk. A football player rushing, a batter hitting, their shoulders blanketed by a thickening layer of dust. History books were piled beside the trophies, including a dog-eared paperback of Baa Black Sheep, an autobiography by Colonel Gregory Pappy Boyington. in the center of the desk, was a letter first opened 4 years before, the envelope yellowing with age at its corners. It had come back from the Enterprise with the rest of his personal effects. His father kept it there. When missing him became too much, his father would sit vigil at the desk and reread the letter. "Hey, Dad. You'll probably hear from me on the phone before you get this letter. But in case it's much longer than that before we talk, I wanted to put pen to paper. These past few days, I've been thinking a lot about Pop-Pop. My first ever memory is of him telling me stories from the Pacific. Later on came Pop's stories about Vietnam. And of course, your stories. If you were here, I'd ask you to tell me the one about the camel spider and sheet cake again. But more than my memory of all those stories is my memory of wanting a story of my own. One that I could tell you. And goddamn if I haven't gathered a few out here. We've been waiting to launch for days now. The weather's been bad. And that's given me time to think. I want you to know that I went into this clear-eyed. All I ever wanted was to hold my own in this family. And I feel like I've done that. But I suspect something else will soon be asked of me. Something more than what you, Pop, or even Pop-Pop had to do. And if I have to do that thing, I want you to know I'm okay with it. If I'm the last in our family ever to fly, it makes sense that I'd have to give the most. When you build a chain, you cast the last link a little thicker than the rest, because that's the anchor point. The most punishment always falls on the anchor point. That's it. That's all I've been thinking about. Be sure to keep taking your heart meds. And thanks for the carton of Marlboro Reds. I love you. Chris. The old man finished reading. He gazed out the window to the fields they used to play in. It was late autumn. The leaves were collected in great piles. He carefully refolded the letter and placed it in its envelope. He sat alone in the chair as the afternoon moved toward darkness. Occasionally, in the distance, he could hear the dull sound of a plane as it passed invisibly overhead.
0740, April 16th, 2039. GMT plus 530. New Delhi. Sandeep Chaudhary had a flight to catch. His taxi to the airport would arrive in a few minutes. The night before, he'd packed meticulously. This would be his first trip back to the United States since he'd left Washington as part of the peace delegation 5 years before. He brought an assortment of clothing, including a suit he would wear to formal meetings, but mostly he packed items to wear in the camps around Galveston and San Diego, which were filled with the internally displaced who had yet to resettle. It was strange for Chaudhary to wonder whether or not he should bring extra soap or toothpaste to an American city, where once you could buy anything. But no longer. At least, that was what the security officer at UN headquarters in Mumbai had said. Truth be told, Chaudhary's distancing from America started when he'd resettled his mother and daughter in New Delhi. His mother, who had now reconciled with her aging brother, was reluctant to leave him. And if his mother was reluctant to leave her brother, Chaudhary couldn't leave his mother. Particularly in light of Ashni's attachment to her grandmother. The girl had already been through so much with the loss of her own mother. This tally of familial obligations led Chaudhary to resign from the administration and stay on in what his uncle insisted on calling your home country. Once Chaudhary had made that decision, he was pleasantly surprised to discover that his expertise was in high demand. After the New Delhi Peace Accords, both the political world and business world opened up to him in a way he could never have anticipated. Not only had he served in the highest levels of the U.S. executive branch, he was an India expert, or simply Indian, if the offending party hadn't read his CV. International lobbyists, think tanks, venture capitalists, sovereign wealth funds, they aggressively courted him with board seats, stock options, and prestigious titles such as Senior Distinguished Fellow, as they vied for his expertise as part of a general clamor to understand India's ascendance as an economic and political juggernaut. For Chaudhry, this meant that he'd had no reason to go back to America. However, packing for this trip, that word, back, came to mind again. Although success after success had come to him since resettling in New Delhi, a certain bitterness remained in how he had left home. How often had he replayed the events of 5 years before in his mind, wondering if a different set of decisions might have led to a different set of outcomes? He thought of Wisecarver, too, whose obstruction of the Indian defense attaché had eventually come to light, a scandal that cost the administration its next election, so that even had Chaudhry stayed on, he would have soon been out of the job. But none of that had ever alleviated the deeper wound, which wasn't the loss of life, as tragic as it had been, but rather the sacrifice of America itself, the idea of it. Chaudhry had packed one suitcase and a carry-on, a day pack he could take when he traveled into the camps. His office at the UN High Commission for Refugees had also advised he bring a sleeping bag. Depending on road conditions and available accommodations, the chance existed that his delegation might need to stay one or two nights in the wretched camps, a detail that Chaudhry kept from his mother, who wouldn't have approved. Cyclical outbreaks of typhus, measles, and even smallpox often sprouted from the unbilged latrines and rows of plastic tenting. These diseases had ravaged communities far and wide, only heightening the cost of the war. Their own hometown of Washington, D.C. had lost nearly 50,000 residents to a vaccine-resistant strain of rubella 2 years before. Chaudhry had wanted to return then to help, but his mother had convinced him not only to remain in New Delhi, but to submit his application for Indian citizenship, which he reluctantly did.
"You need to accept that this might be your home," she had said.
Still, he couldn't quite believe that the America he remembered, the America that Kennedy and Reagan had both called the city upon a hill, might vanish. Except America was an idea, and ideas very seldom vanish. Whenever he despaired, he reminded himself of this. With his bags set by the front door, he stepped into his study, which had once been his uncle's study, the very room where he'd learned of the attacks on Galveston and San Diego. At the corner of the desk sat a photograph of his great-great-grandfather, Lance Nayak Imran Sandeep Patel, of the Rajputana Rifles. This wasn't the photo from the Delhi Gymkhana that his uncle had shown him years before, but a photograph from later on in his great-great-grandfather's life, after his career in the army, once he'd made a modest fortune selling arms during partition to the newly formed Indian government. Although the 40 years between photographs had obscured the resemblance of the young and old versions of the same man, the gaze was unmistakable. It was unrequited, hungry for more, to do more, achieve more, to make a better, safer, more secure, more dignified life. It was, in Chaudhry's estimation, a distinctly American gaze, though the man had never set foot in America. When he considered his great-great-grandfather and considered Reagan and Kennedy, who felt like grandfathers of another sort, and their shared vision of the city upon a hill, he felt assured by the notion that America, as an idea, did not depend upon any particular set of borders to endure. In fact, on this UN-sponsored humanitarian trip, he would be doing his part to restore American ideals to its very shores. Outside, his taxi pulled up. Chaudhry messaged the driver to wait a minute. Another idea rang discordantly in his mind, an idea from another of America's forefathers. These were words spoken by a young Abraham Lincoln 2 decades before the calamity that became the American Civil War. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, Lincoln had said, with all the treasure of the earth, our own excepted, in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of freemen, we must live through all time or die by suicide. A nation of freemen. Chaudhry counted himself among that nation, no matter where it might exist, in Washington, New Delhi, or elsewhere. And so he would travel back to America, hopeful that the spirit of that nation had yet to abandon the place. He had one last item to pack. Opening his desk drawer, he reached for his 2 passports, Indian and American, different shades of the same blue. His hand hovered indecisively over them both. He had a flight to catch. Time was growing short. The taxi began to blare its horn. He stood, the seconds bleeding away. For the life of him, he couldn't decide which to choose. Because no battle is ever won, they are not even fought. The field only reveals to man his own folly and despair, and victory is an illusion of philosophers and fools. William Faulkner.
What follows is an exclusive interview with author Admiral James Stavridis.
I'm Christina Bruni. I am the director of the audiobook for the new novel, 2034, and I am here with Admiral Jim Stavridis. Admiral Stavridis spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy, rising to the rank of 4-star admiral. He was Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, commanded a Navy destroyer, a destroyer squadron, and an aircraft carrier battle group in combat. He recently served for 5 years as Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and has published 8 previous books. Admiral Stavridis is Chief International Security and Diplomacy Analyst for NBC News and a columnist at both Time Magazine and Bloomberg Opinion. Based in Washington, D.C., he is an operating executive of the Carlyle Group, an international private equity firm, and chair of the board of counselors of McLarty Associates, an international consulting firm. Thank you so much for coming and sharing more of your experience with us, Admiral Stavridis.
Thanks so much, Christina.
We wanted to ask to have this time with you because this is an interesting situation. You are a best-selling novel author of many nonfiction titles. Why did you choose to present this warning in the form of a novel? How did the format of a novel make it easier, or maybe it was more challenging, to deliver the message that you wanted to send?
Sure. Let's start with the title of the book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War. So for starters, if the idea of the book, and it is to present a kind of cautionary tale to the audience, you have to set it into the future. Fiction is the only option to do that. Secondly, only fiction allows a truly character-driven story to unfold. And at the end of the day, 2034 is a novel of human beings. It's not technology. It's not about world events. Those are certainly part of it. But it is a very character-driven study that ought to, for each of us, provide a kind of cautionary tale about how devastating an outcome like a war with China could be. And then third and finally, I would say, you know, if you think of disasters that have befallen our country, 9/11, Pearl Harbor, in the end, they're less failures of intelligence and more failures of imagination. We simply couldn't imagine that the Japanese Empire would decide to strike Pearl Harbor. We couldn't imagine that a group of terrorists could knock down the World Trade Towers, attack the Pentagon, bring down four commercial airliners. And as a result of that, we have to say we need to imagine more in terms of dangers, cautions, and stories. That's how we can protect ourselves the best. Fiction allows us to do that.
Thank you. So the crisis in 2034 begins with a Chinese cyber attack in the U.S., which severely limits military and diplomatic capabilities. One of your main characters says the way to defeat technology isn't with more technology. It is with no technology. In 2016, Christopher Hayes wrote a master's thesis for the Naval Postgraduate School, which detailed similar risks in real life and advocated for maritime training in celestial navigation and other low-tech capabilities to safeguard against cyber attacks. However, 2034 also mentions a whole swath of officers in our military who cling to a cult of technology. How did you see that low-tech, high-tech tension within cybersecurity solutions evolve over your long naval career?
Well, let's go back to when I graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in the late 1970s, you know, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago. So in those days, when we went out to sea, how did we navigate? How did we figure out where we were on this vast, trackless ocean? Well, I picked up an object called a sextant, and literally shot, as the saying goes, shot the stars, shot the sun, shot the moon, took readings on the locations of those celestial bodies. In doing that, I was navigating precisely as navigators had done 400 years earlier. Think Captain Cook in the Pacific in the 1700s. So at the start of my career, there was no cyber. There was no global positioning system, a constellation of satellites in the sky above us. So I started in a very low-tech world in that sense. By the middle of my career, when I became a captain of a destroyer for the first time in my late 30s, technology had come along. We had these satellites in space. We could look at what would today appear to be fairly primitive devices, but they gave us a very good sense of physically where we were on the planet. GPS, it was called, Global Positioning System, had become pretty essential to navigating ships, and by the way, to conducting combat operations to make sure bombs get where they need to go. So that's the middle of my career. Toward the end of my career, now I'm a four-star admiral, probably due to a computer error of some kind, but there I am in command, Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, and everything is focused on GPS, on cyber. All of our capability as I prosecute combat operations in Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, Syria, piracy operations, all of that is built on the absolute structure of cyber and GPS. Now, in today's world, as we potentially, unfortunately, look at the possibilities of conflict with near peer competitors like Russia and China, they have the ability to disrupt that cyber. They have the ability to disrupt that GPS constellation of satellites. That wasn't a concern in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria. None of those opponents had the ability to disrupt that GPS cyber network. China and Russia do. That's why we must, again, imagine our way into a future, perhaps as close as the year 2034, where our opponents can reach in and take apart that system of cyber and space that protects us today. That's why it's so important that we think ourselves into the future with this book.
Regarding U.S. cybersecurity, you wrote, the deregulation that resulted in so much American innovation and economic strength was now an American weakness. Its disaggregated online infrastructure was vulnerable in a way that the Chinese infrastructure was not. Based on your experience, how prepared are we for a cyber threat? What changes would help protect us?
When I was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, people would ask me all the time, Admiral, what keeps you awake at night? You know, is it Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, piracy? What really worries you? And the answer is none of those things. I thought we were well prepared to handle that level of combat. What keeps me awake at night then and today is cyber and our vulnerabilities in cyber. And the reason is because of this vast threat surface that is presented, all the ways we can be attacked in cyber. And I'll give you some numbers that go with that. Go back to 2011, 10 years ago, and there were 7 billion people on the planet Earth and 7 billion devices connected to the internet. Today, 2021, 10 years later, there are still a little over 7 billion people on the planet. There are 40 billion devices connected to that internet. Now, that's great. I can pick up my smartphone and open my garage door from 1,000 miles away. Terrific. But 40 billion devices means 40 billion avenues that our opponents can dive into. They can find their way from the most innocuous device. The thermostat on an aquarium in Las Vegas was used to get into the cyber financial networks of the whole casino system in Nevada. Major cyber crime. Only one example. So this vast threat surface is what ought to concern us. And we have yet to put in place the systems and the protections that will keep us safe. And I'll give you 3 quick things we should think about. Number one, we need a cyber force. The United States has an army, a navy, a Marine Corps, an Air Force. We just created a Space Force. Smart move. But what we really need is a cyber force. We need a dedicated cadre, not huge, maybe 10 to 15,000 men and women who would help protect us in cyber space. And that could be the work of a cyber force. Number two, we need just better education in the country, particularly in STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. We need great minds thinking about these problems. So education is a second major area where we could improve. And thirdly, international negotiation. Why have we never had a nuclear attack in the decades since nuclear weapons were invented, despite periods of high tension? The short answer to the question is because we have conducted sensible international negotiations, created international treaties, created a regime of deterrence. We need that for cyberspace. We're not there yet. So there's 3 areas that I try to focus folks on as we think about our cybersecurity.
In 2034, you introduce one of the characters' reservations in the midst of a military crisis with a sentiment that many Americans may have felt over recent years. The America that we believe ourselves to be is no longer the America that we are. Is that your assessment or more an observation of other people's concerns? How important do you think it would be for our country to have a shared sense of identity in the midst of a crisis sparked by an external threat?
Let's start with the events of 6 January 2021. If that was not a wake-up call for us, I don't know what a wake-up call would look like. Here we saw fellow Americans, fellow citizens, storm the capital of the United States, desecrating the most profound temple of democracy, not just in our nation, but in the world. How on earth did we hit that point? And how do we square those images, those terrible images, with our self-view as this temple of democracy? We've always thought of ourselves as this shining city on a hill, as President Reagan would say. Maybe that shining city on a hill needs some work. And certainly for me, 6 January was in many ways the ultimate wake-up call. So the question is, what should we be doing as a nation in this regard? And I'll give you 3 things that I think are important that we should consider and focus upon. And by the way, I'll make a point. I'm a political centrist. I'm a registered independent, not a Republican or a Democrat. I have, as a senior military officer, always stayed out of the maelstrom of politics. I was vetted for vice president by Hillary Clinton, one of six people actually vetted. And I was offered a cabinet post by Donald Trump's administration. I kind of think of that, by the way, as two bullets whizzing by my head. I mention all that to simply point out I'm a centrist, a moderate, neither Republican or Democrat. So here's three, I think, bipartisan ideas to consider. One is service. We need to celebrate the idea of service. And here I don't just mean saying to military people, thank you for your service. We all appreciate that. But there are so many ways to serve this country. Certainly our military, but our police, our firefighters, our diplomats, CIA officers, doctors and nurses on the front line of this pandemic. How about school teachers in upstate New York teaching a packed classroom under COVID restrictions for $37,000 a year? You think they're serving the country? I sure do. And I will tell you, we ought to celebrate that idea of service because service is bipartisan. It's nonpartisan. It crosses those political divides. We ought to celebrate it. We ought to incentivize it. Things like the Peace Corps, Teach for America, Volunteer for America, certainly military service. All of the things I've mentioned ought to be celebrated and incentivized. Number two, and I mentioned it earlier in the context of STEM, but here I mean it differently, education. We need to invest in educating at every level. And I think this is something that with the new administration, not simply President Biden, but Dr. Jill Biden, a lifelong educator, will help bring that kind of sensibility into the White House and into the cabinet. I think that we need to invest more in education, and it needs to include not only the STEM topics I mentioned earlier, but also our history, our civics. What does it mean to be a citizen of the United States? What are our privileges, but what are our responsibilities at the same time? And by the way, some component of that education in dealing with this divide we face ought to be focused on teaching, particularly young people, how to use the internet responsibly, how to understand what is true and what is garbage on the internet. And there are technical ways to do that. There are techniques that can be applied to it. But the idea that we hand a supercomputer, which is also known as an iPhone 10, to a child when she or he are but 10 and a half years old, that's the average age at which we give our children their first smartphone. You can make a case for that and against it, but you cannot dispute we need to educate them better and more responsibly. So number two, teach people how to deal with this massive flow of information they deal with. And then third and finally, I would say as citizens, as voters, we have a responsibility to find candidates who want to reach across the aisles, who want to get to solutions. And I'll give you a very practical example. I spent 5 years in Massachusetts as the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I'm a native Floridian, Massachusetts. I was a stranger in a strange land up there. But I will tell you, the governor of Massachusetts, which is among the most liberal states in the country, is named Charlie Baker, and he's a Republican. Now, how does that happen? How does a Republican get elected to be the governor of one of the most liberal states in the country? The answer is he works hard to reach across aisles. He reaches very hard as a Republican out to the Democrats. To conclude, I'll give you an example of a young congressman who was my congressman when I lived in Massachusetts. And his name is Seth Moulton. And he's a Democrat. But Seth Moulton is part of the Problem Solver Caucus. He's also a veteran, understands service, and is very willing to reach across aisles to solve problems. I would argue wherever you are on the political spectrum, whether you watch Fox News every single day or you watch MSNBC every day, you have a vested interest as a citizen of the United States to find candidates who want to work together, whatever the policies you choose to pursue. So there's three ideas, and God help us if we don't find ways to close this divide in this nation.
Naval aviator Chris Wedge is one of the main characters in your novel. You write that Wedge's family history of military service ties us back to the last time we defeated a peer-level military. Seeing him reminds people of what we as a nation are capable of accomplishing. How did your own family's history of military service influence your career choices and your decision to emphasize Wedge's family and military history in 2034? How does America's current military differ from the forces who fought in last century's conflicts?
Well, let's start with Wedge. That's his call sign. He's an aviator, so they all have to have a cool call sign. And he's one of my favorite characters in the book. I mean, he's ripped right out of the movie Top Gun. He's entirely lovable as a type, and he's brave, and he's decent. And as you point out correctly, he is the descendant of a very famous military family. But I'll tell you who I had in mind as I wrote that character, and my co-author, Elliot Ackerman, wrote that character. In my mind, I thought of my daughter, Julia. And my daughter, Julia, spent 4 years on active duty, Navy officer. Julia's father, obviously, me, four-star Navy admiral. Both of Julia's grandfathers were naval officers. One grandfather was a naval aviator. The other one was a Marine colonel. And Julia's great-grandfather was an Army colonel. So Julia is a fourth-generation military officer. And there's real power in that ethos of what families pass on to each other. And you know, in today's America, only 1% of the population is on active duty at any one time. About 5% roughly are veterans of the military. So it's a small cadre. And I think the values of courage and honor and commitment, I think those are passed. And so I'm very proud of Wedge. As I read Wedge's character, I always think of my daughter, Julia, and I'm very proud of her. How are they different? Let me say this. They're better. They're much better. And each generation, I would say, improved on its predecessor in the military context. But in particular, this generation of millennials are diverse, extremely diverse. You know, we've worked our way out of don't ask, don't tell to now you can openly serve as LGBTQI in the military. That is a very good thing for our military. Number two, most obviously, they're tech savvy as hell. I mean, I'm a tourist in the digital world. I came to it late. These are digital natives. They can't imagine life without that supercomputer, that iPhone in their hand. So tech savvy beyond the capability of my generation to even imagine, let alone my father and my grandfather. And then third and finally, we've talked a lot about it, but this is also a highly educated military. It's because it's an all-volunteer force. We pay them well. They still take great risks on our behalf. But you can't even enlist in the military if you're not in the top 20% of your high school class. You have to have a high school degree. Officer ranks are all college educated. Most, the majority, have at least a master's degree. It's a highly educated force. And then fourth and finally on millennials, I think they're underestimated. And I look back, you know, we always like to talk, and we should, about that World War II generation. We call them the greatest generation. If you look at cycles of generations in American history, about every third cycle, fourth cycle, there comes a hero generation. The greatest generation was a hero generation. Then you go through the baby booms and the, X and Y and this generation, these millennials, I have seen them stand and deliver in Afghanistan, in Iraq, flying over the South China Sea, in the Arctic, in every imaginable condition, these people that are now in their 20s and 30s, they are a hero generation. And our path out of many of our troubles in this nation will come through that millennial generation. And that's why Wedge is such an important character in the book.
Does that link back to Samuel Huntington's idea of generational change in American history that he's traced back through his work?
It absolutely does. And there are many, many studies of this. And Huntington's work, by the way, is not only in that sphere, the citizen soldier, but also his perhaps most famous, his most famous book is called The Clash of Civilizations, which is about peer competition for the United States and democracies against totalitarian regimes. So Huntington was prescient in so many ways, and you're right to raise him.
Wonderful. Thank you. One of the characters in the novel makes a distinction between tragic events, which could have been avoided through de-escalation, and inevitable events that are the foregone conclusion of a particular international situation. In the heat of the moment, how do leaders distinguish between these two types of crises? In your own experience, how have different political factors made de-escalation easier or harder? Is cyber war inevitable?
Let's go back just over 100 years ago. And this has been World War I very much in my mind as Elliot Ackerman and I wrote 2034. In World War I, there was no reason whatsoever for the nations of Europe to go to war. They were intermarried at the highest levels. All of these royal families were entirely intertwined. Their economies were intertwined. Yes, they'd had a long history of war, but that should have informed them of how terrible a massive war would be. Yet they managed to effectively sleepwalk into a war, never thinking it would actually happen. It sparked as a result of an assassination of a member of the royal family, the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the Balkans. And yet, at that point, the leaders of those nations should have been able to consciously step back from the precipice of what was, in effect, a global war. They failed to do so. And they failed because of complacency. They just couldn't imagine it could happen. Again, that theme of imagining. They had interlocking alliances that bound them too closely in a certain sense. They did not appreciate history, and they didn't have the technology to instantly communicate. Now come forward 100 years to your question. What's new is cyber. And there's good and there's danger. The good is this world of cyber gives us effectively instantaneous communication and more importantly, instantaneous awareness of what's happening globally. The bad side of it is that it is still hidden away. We don't have clarity on what is happening in the cyber world. Our opponents and we ourselves have the ability to penetrate each other's networks. We just saw a huge hack here in the United States. Some call it the Cyber Winds hack. All the major nations, and particularly China, with whom we're concerned in 2034, have the ability to get into each other's networks. So there's danger and there are positives. And no, I don't think a cyber war is inevitable, but if we're going to avoid it, and this again is kind of the point of the book, 2034, if we're going to avoid it, it will be because we think about and imagine how terrible it would be if we got into a war. Number two, we look at history and recognize that even if you think you're not going to get in a war, events can overtake you. A small spark can start a huge fire. So what we need to do is create a system of deterrence in the cyber world, which is what we have with nuclear weapons today. And the sooner we get that system of deterrence in place, the less likely we are to be confronted with the kind of apocalyptic events we talk about in 2034.
How do you hope readers and listeners respond to the novel?
I hope it scares the hell out of them. And it scared the hell out of me writing it. And I look back on some Cold War literature in this regard. Some of our listeners may have seen, and it's a wonderful movie to go back and watch, Dr. Strangelove, which is a black and white film. Peter Sellers is the star. And it's the story of how the U.S. and Russia, the Soviet Union, stumble into an apocalyptic nuclear war. Another one is The Bedford Incident, which is a novel about a U.S. destroyer and a Soviet submarine playing a very dangerous game of cat and mouse in the North Atlantic. They manage to avoid a war, but tactically, the events are quite tragic. And then third, at the truly dark end of the spectrum, is Neville Shute's novel, On the Beach, which is set in Australia, also a very good film, and is about a world in which radioactivity gradually begins to threaten the entire human race. There was a rich literature in the Cold War that I think contributed to deterrence. It helped people imagine how terrible events would be if we stumbled into a war. It scared them. And I hope that 2034 will scare people and our decision makers and even our militaries so that they do all they can to avoid the kind of outcome described in the novel.
Well, thank you for writing it. Thank you for scaring all of us, I think. And thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. And our listeners, I'm sure, will really appreciate getting to hear a little bit more of how your experience intersected with writing the novel and how well-informed all of the plot lines in the novel are really all based in fact. And getting that from your perspective has been really helpful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Christina and Richie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 2034. A Novel of the Next World War, by Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis. Sarah Hunt's sections were read by Emily Wu Zeller. Chris Wedge Mitchell's sections were read by P.J. Oakland. Dr. Sandeep Sandy Chaudhry's sections were read by Vikas Adam. Lin Bao's sections were read by Dion Graham. Qasem Farshad's sections were read by Fyodor Chin. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive Producer Kelly Gilday. Edited by JSR Post, LLC. Text copyright 2021 by Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis. Production copyright 2021 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.